Sorry, Logan. I don't quite get... I looked at it just before Mum went missing. Logan tapped his finger on the screen. It's further out from the city, but it would be worth it for more space. Had his anxiety about his mother made him lose his mind? I also bought you a ring, he said. It's in my sock drawer. She stared at him. Obviously, I'm not proposing. Not now. Not when my father is about to be arrested for murdering my mother. It's just that you're here looking... He gestured up and down at her body as if it were obvious what he wanted to say. She looked down at herself, mystified. She was wearing a comfortable shift dress that he must have seen 100 times before. Her nose was red around the nostrils from a cold last week. Looking so bloody beautiful, he said. And his voice broke on the word beautiful. Indira was stunned. She had never seen him cry. Not even close. When they first started dating, he used to call her beautiful all the time and she'd snap at him because it embarrassed her. It made her feel as if she needed to urgently call out to a derisive audience, "Don't laugh, I know it's not true." So eventually he stopped saying it. She'd successfully trained her beautiful boyfriend not to call her beautiful. Logan rested his head in his hands. His voice was muffled. Sorry. I don't know why I said that. It just came out. I'm so tired. It's okay. She put her hand on the back of his neck and leaned in close to his ear. Everything is going to be okay. She didn't know that, of course. All she knew was that right now she was going to make him eat and then sleep. And then she was going to stay by his side for whatever horrendous or wondrous things lay ahead. Chapter 58. Beautiful day, commented Ethan to Christina as they drove towards Stan Delaney's home to arrest him for his wife's murder. It is. Christina looked out the car window at the cloudless blue sky. How do you think he'll react? Asked Ethan. Ethan's shirt today was an exquisite teal blue, the colour of a bridesmaid's dress. Christina looked down and saw a small stain like old blood on her shirt. That's what happened when he got dressed in the dark so as not to wake your partner. It was probably tomato sauce. My bet is he'll be calm, said Christina. He will have been given legal advice not to say a word. Her phone began to ring with an unfamiliar number. Detective Corey, she answered, preemptively brusque. Nico told her she sounded too angry on the phone. He said not everyone was a potential criminal. He was wrong. Everyone was so a potential criminal or a potential victim. Hi there, Detective Corey. How are you? It was the posh, velvety tone of a man who was confident that his social status was superior to that of the vast majority of the population. Christina was irritated. Who is this? This is Dr. Henry Edgeworth. I understand you've been trying to reach me. I've just returned from overseas. Most people sounded nervous when returning a phone call from the police, but not this wanker. Yes, that's right, said Christina. Took your bloody time, mate. It's in relation to a missing woman, Joy Delaney. Delaney, he repeated, his silk-smooth voice snagged. There was a phone call from your apartment to her on the 14th of February this year. Christina felt Ethan's attention on her half of the conversation. He would have worked out that it was the plastic surgeon finally returning their call. I'm afraid I can't help you, he said. I don't know anyone by that name. Can you explain why our phone records show a phone call from the landline at your apartment on that day that lasted 40 minutes? Perhaps you've got the wrong Dr. Edgeworth. Right, said Christina. Or is it possible that someone else could have made a phone call from your apartment? A family member? Your wife? He was guarded now. My wife and children never stay at the apartment. We have a family home in the eastern suburbs. The apartment is just a small one-bedroom near the hospital for when I'm working late. It's more convenient. Yeah, I bet it's more convenient, thought Christina. We have no doubt that the call came from your apartment. We also believe it's probable that Joy Delaney met with foul play, said Christina. So I really need you to think carefully about this. Another pause. Is this the old lady? I saw the husband on the news. That's right, said Christina. Well, he cleared his throat. Well, all right, I can tell you that I did have someone staying at the apartment a few weeks back, a family friend. Girlfriend, definitely a girlfriend. So now I think about it, I'm guessing she was the one who called this lady, said Dr. Edgeworth. His voice grew in confidence. In fact, I'd say she definitely did. I expect they're related. Christina said, why would you expect that? Well, as it happens, this girl's name was Savannah Delaney. Savannah Delaney, repeated Christina, looking at Ethan. His eyebrows had popped. Right from the beginning, she'd known that Savannah was at the very centre of this investigation, and yet they still hadn't managed to locate the damned woman. Maybe she's her niece or something. She said her mother was dead. When did you last have contact with her? Not for a while now, said Dr. Edgeworth. Actually, the last time we spoke was probably, let me think, Valentine's Day. Chapter 59. Simon Barrington's breath quickened as he stared at the words on his laptop screen. Was it a coincidence? Was he misremembering the words in Amy's mother's text? Did this mean nothing or everything? Had he just accidentally cracked the case of the disappearance of Joy Delaney? He was sitting at the dining room table. He knew Amy was at home. She'd just walked in the door and given him a silent, stiff wave before running up the stairs to her room. She was so fragile right now, like a delicate glass version of herself. You knew this wasn't ever going to be a thing, right? She'd told him when they broke up a few days ago, although Simon wasn't sure if there was anything to break. She made it sound as if there were blindingly obvious ethical considerations that prevented them from being together, as if they were married politicians from opposing parties, not flatmates with a larger-than-conventional age gap. They could have given it a shot. But he said, sure, I knew that, because he didn't want anything to be difficult for her right now, and she was looking at him with such desperate entreaty. I'm hard work, she told him. I'm hard work even when my mother isn't missing. He could have quoted his dad's favourite Kris Kristofferson song and told her that loving her was easier than anything he'd ever do again. He could have said, let me help you get through this. He could have said a lot of things, but he just said, mildly, I like hard work. I'm a hard worker. Then he felt bad because she'd looked like she was about to cry. So he'd said, it's fine, Amy. Don't worry about me. Focus on your mother. There were footsteps on the stairs again. Was she going straight back out? Amy, he called. She came into the dining room. Hi, she said. She looked pale and tired, but composed. I'm on my way out. My brother is picking me up. He thinks my dad might get arrested today. She smiled without it reaching her eyes. Lucky I got in a quick session with my shrink. I'm good to go. That text message your mother sent, said Simon. Did it mention the number 21? Amy looked startled. I think it did, but they were just random nonsense words. She did that when she texted without glasses. She tapped at her phone and showed him the text message. The wording was exactly as he remembered. Well, this might not be anything, said Simon, but I was just thinking about Savannah and how it turned out she was Harry Haddad's sister. So then I was Googling Harry and I was looking at his charity work and I noticed this. He moved the laptop around so she could see the words. She looked at the screen, then at her mother's text message and back at the screen again. He saw her catch her breath. Chapter 60. Does this change anything? Ethan frowned. That Joy talked to Savannah on the day she disappeared? And that was also the last day Dr. Edgeworth had contact with Savannah? They'd stopped at an intersection and he looked over at Christina, his hands on the wheel, trust and respect in his eyes, as if this was a question with a right or wrong answer, and that Christina, with her years of experience, would know the answer, and all he had to do was ask for it. He thought she had some special knowledge, and that one day he would attain that knowledge, and for a vertiginous moment she felt like a kid, pretending she was an experienced detective. I'm just little Chrissy Khoury, Ethan. What the hell would I know? What do you think? She said. Good mentoring. Well, said Ethan, is it possible that Joy and Savannah are somewhere together? It's possible, said Christina. Anything is possible without a body. Call us when you've got a body, the guys in homicide said. Accept nothing. Believe nothing. Check everything. Should they turn around? It doesn't change the evidence, she said. The scratch marks, the bloodied T-shirt, the CCTV footage, the motive. We've got plenty. Their interview with Savannah's famous brother had told them exactly nothing. Harry Haddad spoke with fond respect of his former coaches, Joy and Stan Delaney, but said he hadn't spoken to his sister in many years. He thought his father might once have had an email address for her, but he wasn't sure. Harry was estranged from his mother and had no contact details for her either. My mother remarried multiple times, he said. I'm not even sure what surname she's decided to use these days. His tone, initially warm and helpful, had begun to fray as he discussed his complicated family history. Savannah was an optical illusion, a distraction. Her only relevance was that she'd given Stan a motive to murder his wife. So we're still going to arrest him, said Ethan. We're still going to arrest him, said Christina. And then we're going to track down this Savannah, whoever the fuck she is, and arrest her too. For what? For pissing me off, said Christina. Ethan grinned. Fair enough. Chapter 61. Caro Azinovich sat in the front room of her house, drinking a cup of tea while she enjoyed an overdue telephone call with her daughter in Denmark. She watched a white car pull up outside the Delaney's house and a man and a woman emerge. They both wore suits. There was something purposeful and foreboding about the way they walked towards the front door. She thought of the security camera footage she and her son had given to the police. Oh, dear God, her son had said as they watched it together. You can't actually see what he's carrying, Caro had said.
At that time of night, said Jacob, it doesn't look good, Mum.
Caro and her daughter had only exchanged a few brief emails since she'd been in Sydney last month, and they were overdue for a catch-up. Petra was up very late on the other side of the world because she was upset about a complicated issue regarding her son's school, and Caro listened sympathetically. She'd thought the Danish were so socially advanced that there wouldn't be such a thing as schoolyard politics over there, but apparently it was universal. I think the police might be at Joy's house right now, she told Petra when she finally finished her story.
Why would the police be there?
Caro filled her in on the dreadful details. Her daughter sounded panicked. But, Mum, why didn't you tell me any of this before?
Well, this is the first time we've properly talked since you went back, so it didn't even occur to me. To be honest, I've been so het up about it all.
Mum, you need to tell me the name of whoever is in charge of the investigation. Right now.
But why?
Because I saw Joy Delaney on Valentine's Day. Chapter 62. The street was deathly quiet as they pulled into the driveway. Not even the sound of a leaf blower in the distance. As they walked towards the house, Christina's phone began to ring, a strident sound in the silence. She flicked it to voicemail.
Good morning, sighed Stan Delaney when he opened the door to them, as if they were unwelcome but expected visitors.
Which Christina guessed was exactly what they were. He was unshaven today, bare feet, in shorts and a black T-shirt.
Come in.
He led them down the hallway, past the framed photos. There was a faded gap where the framed photo they'd seized had hung. The house smelled of toast. They went into the living room, where they'd had all their previous discussions. Stan gestured at the couch.
You haven't found her, have you? He said suddenly.
Afterwards, Christina would think back to that moment and wonder if this was when she should have known that something wasn't right. Because while his face most certainly showed fear, which she'd expect, it also showed hope. And why would he be hopeful? Yet, even if she'd stopped to second-guess herself, she would have been reassured by the good, solid evidence that had led her to this point. Her gut instinct had been supported by piece after piece of compelling evidence. This was not the time for second-guessing. She spoke clearly. Stan Delaney, you're under arrest for the murder of Joy Margaret Delaney. He didn't flinch. His face hardened and smoothed, as if he were slowly but perceptibly turning to stone. You don't have to say or do anything unless you want to. Anything you do say or do will be, Ethan said. Christina, he had his head tilted, as if he were listening to something. I think there might be, she ignored him and continued speaking to Stan. Anything you do say or do will be recorded and may later be used as evidence. Do you understand that?
Yes, said Stan. I understand that.
Detective Khoury, said Ethan formally, a bit louder. What? She felt a spasm of irritation. Ethan lifted his chin to indicate something in the hallway behind her. Christina turned around at the same time as a small woman with white, shoulder-length hair came into the room, removing a backpack from her shoulders. A set of keys dangled from her finger. Christina had been thinking so much about this woman and her life and her choices. It was as discombobulating as seeing a glamorous movie star in the flesh. Stan Delaney walked like a man in a dream towards his wife and lifted her right off her feet. Her keys crashed to the floor. Stan cried, his hand cradling the back of his wife's head. He cried like a man cries when he has little or no experience of crying, dry sobs that racked his body. It was the first time Christina had seen Stan Delaney, the man she wanted to convict for his wife's murder, display even a modicum of emotion.
"What in the world?" said Joy Delaney.
Chapter 63. Valentine's Day. Stan Delaney felt his colossal rage and humiliation, his pain and hurt, balloon within his chest and explode behind his eyes. But he was not his father. Just like his father had not been his father that day, the day his body finally reacted to the daily onslaught of cruelty. That one action had defined the rest of his father's life and the rest of Stan's life. He might be as stupid as his father, as thick as a brick, but he would never make his father's mistake. He would never hurt a woman, not any woman, but especially not this woman, not the fair-haired, tiny girl with the springy walk who had materialized like a miracle at that party all those years ago and smiled up at him with gleaming, combative eyes. He'd known, before that song finished its last silly synthetic beat, that she was the only girl for him. More than 50 years later, he dropped his violently trembling hands. He turned away. He didn't slam the door. He closed it with a gentle click behind him. Chapter 64. Now.
"Your family has been very worried about you, Mrs. Delaney."
Christina managed to keep her voice steady as she thought of the time and resources she'd spent trying to prove this woman's murder. She thought of her boss's face. Accept nothing, believe nothing, check everything. She hadn't followed her own rules. They should have turned around once they got the information from the plastic surgeon about Savannah speaking to Joy on the same day she disappeared.
"But I don't understand," said Joy Delaney.
She stood next to her husband, holding his hand in hers, patting it distractedly. She looked well-rested and tanned.
"Why would you call the police, Stan? You knew exactly where I was. I left you a note."
"I never got a note," said Stan shakily. He was a plant returning to life in front of Christina's eyes, back straightening, shoulders dropping. "There was no note, Joy." He exhaled hard. "At first, I thought you were just making a point. But this last week, you know, I really started to think something terrible had happened to you."
"There was so a note," insisted Joy. "I put it on the fridge door so you couldn't possibly miss it."
"There was no note on the fridge," said Stan. "Where have you been?"
"But I left it right there. It was a very nice note. I put a lot of thought into it."
Stan said, "Did you use the London Eye fridge magnet, Joy?"
"Oh," said Joy. She grimaced. "That was stupid. Oh, dear."
"This fridge magnet is top-heavy," said Stan to Christina. He was almost chummy with her now. "Bad design. It keeps falling off the fridge."
"It's a pity because it's a lovely magnet," said Joy. "It has a picture of us on the London Eye."
"You didn't see the note on the floor?" said Christina to Stan, still treating him as a man with something to hide.
"I did not," said Stan.
"But surely you called the children, Stan. I texted them," said Joy.
"The text made no sense, Joy," said Stan. "It was gibberish."
Joy looked at Christina and Ethan.
Has he even offered you a cup of tea?
We didn't expect a cup of tea, said Christina. We were in the process of arresting him. The dog pattered into the room and happily licked Joy's shoes. Christina shuffled out of its way. She'd met Steffi a few times now, and the animal seemed harmless and cute enough, but she wasn't a pet person, and she had the strangest feeling that this one actively disliked her. Joy fondled the dog's ears.
Hello, Steffi. Did you miss me?
Stan said, you know, I've got a good idea what happened to that note.
Oh, Steffi, said Joy.
The dog eats paper, Stan explained to Christina as Joy bent to pick up the keys she'd dropped and was suddenly transfixed by something she saw on the floor.
Stan, she said.
She put her hands flat to the floorboards and looked up at him.
You like it?
He beamed.
It looks beautiful, she said rapturously. Oh, my goodness, it looks beautiful.
Joy straightened up again, her eyes still on the floor.
We had this awful purple carpet in here. She corrected herself quickly. Well, it wasn't awful. It was just not really my style.
Stan said, it's okay. It was awful.
Anyway, while I've been away, Stan pulled up all the carpet and polished the floorboards. Doesn't it look beautiful?
I sanded the floorboards myself, said Stan. Christina looked at Ethan and knew that he too was replaying the CCTV footage they'd seen. Not of a man carrying his wife's body, but a man struggling to carry a roll of old carpet. A man finally doing a particular task his wife had probably been asking him to do for years. She thought of the witness who had seen him with bloodshot eyes and covered in dust, not because he'd buried his wife, but because he'd been sanding back hardwood floors. Joy's smile faded.
I'm sorry, did you say you were about to arrest Stan?
Arrest him for what? There was a moment of silence. Right now, Stan Delaney couldn't look any sweeter or more innocent if he'd tried. He couldn't take his shining eyes off his wife. Christina reminded herself that every one of her colleagues would have made an arrest based on the facts at her disposal.
Speeding?
Guessed Joy.
He has got a terrible lead foot.
No, not speeding, said Christina evenly. She closed her eyes and tapped a fingertip against her forehead. Her mother had recently got into tapping for stress relief.
We were arresting him for your murder.
Murder? Said Joy. Her eyes widened.
You thought he murdered me?
The evidence was compelling, said Christina, almost to herself.
But how could it possibly be compelling?
Joy held out her arms wide.
I'm alive!
Yes, said Christina. You certainly appear to be.
Surely you spoke to our children, said Joy to Christina. They would have set you straight. Didn't Stan give you their telephone numbers?
They had that T-shirt. Stan spoke to Joy as if they were alone, the one we used to wrap up your foot when you cut it on the oyster that day at the beach. Remember? They found it buried out the back. They thought I buried it.
Of course I remember, said Joy. I thought I put it in the bin. I bet Caro's damned cat ran off with it. Otis steals laundry all around the neighbourhood.
Her voice trailed.
I don't understand. Are you saying you thought it was...
She looked at Christina with a sick expression.
You thought it was my blood?
Well, it was your blood, said Stan reasonably.
But for goodness sake, Stan, surely you explained. It was very simple to explain.
Of course I was going to explain, but by the time they found the shirt, it was obvious I was in trouble. I decided not to say anything until I had my lawyer with me, said Stan.
Your lawyer? Scoffed Joy. What lawyer? You don't have a lawyer.
Brooke found me a criminal lawyer. Nice young fella. Turns out his father was that Ross Marshall who used to play at the club back in the 80s. Remember him?
Watching Stan talk, Christina was reminded oddly of herself. She wasn't a big talker. Nico was the talker. But when they were back together after any time apart, she suddenly became chatty Cathy, desperate to tell him everything she'd been saving up.
The one with the underhand serve? Asked Joy vaguely.
That's the one, said Stan. He plays lawn bowls now. Probably suits him better.
You can't genuinely have thought he murdered me, said Joy to Christina.
I had those scratches on my face, said Stan.
It looked like you scratched me. That's because I did scratch you, said Joy. She splayed her right hand to display her fingernails. I felt terrible about that.
So you didn't get it from a hedge, said Christina to Stan. At least her instincts had been correct there. He met Christina's eyes. I knew how that might have looked to you.
He'd lied in a criminal investigation. She could charge him with perverting the course of justice. Depending on his wife's actions, she could charge her with public mischief. She was going to bloody well charge someone with something today.
Joy sank suddenly onto the couch.
This is quite upsetting.
It has been quite upsetting, yes, said Stan dryly.
He sat next to her, so close their legs touched. The dog sat on the floor in between them, her tail sweeping back and forth. Joy pulled a cushion out from behind her back and placed it on her lap.
I hope people don't hear about this.
The dog rolled over on her back and displayed her tummy, which Joy began to rub with her foot.
People have heard about it, sweetheart. There was a press conference, said Stan. You're a missing person. It was on the news. There were helicopters, people tramping through the reserve looking for you.
Looking for me? Like I was hiding under a bush? Oh, my Lord.
So let me get this straight. You're saying your dog ate the letter you left, said Christina, and your neighbour's cat ran off with the bloodied T-shirt.
Lots of pets involved with this case, Detective Curry, commented Ethan soberly.
So it seems, Constable Lim.
Christina shot him a look. His eyes danced. She bowed her head and squeezed the bridge of her nose while she considered the absurdity of this case.
Perhaps on the way home she and Ethan would rescue a kitten caught in a tree while the townspeople cheered.
Why did you clean your car, Mr. Delaney? Asked Christina, 2 days after your wife went missing.
Why did you insist on doing everything possible to make yourself look guilty?
Joy has been saying for months that the car smells of sour milk, said Stan.
I spilled a banana milkshake, said Joy.
So I thought I'd surprise her.
He beamed at Joy. It smells like a brand new car now.
Oh, Stan.
Joy's hands went to her mouth in the classic gesture of a girl whose boyfriend has gone down on one knee.
You paid someone to clean the car?
Did it cost a fortune?
It was highway robbery, said Stan.
I also bought a mobile phone. Also highway robbery.
You did not, said Joy.
Her foot stopped rubbing. The dog looked up at her hopefully.
I'll give you my number, said Stan.
They were looking straight into each other's eyes. So you can always contact me, said Stan. Always. I'll never turn it off. I'll always answer. Joy took his hand in hers. Okay, she said. Okay, then. The words were not startling, but it felt somehow as if they were witnessing a startlingly intimate conversation, and Christina found herself politely looking away from the couple and at the floorboards. Nico said there were good floorboards waiting beneath the vile carpet in the house they'd just bought. Amazing to think something beautiful could lie beneath the ugliness, and all you had to do was peel it away. She felt her irritation dissolve beneath a slow-moving but inexorable tide of elation. Joy Delaney was no longer missing, presumed dead. She was alive and in excellent health. Christina no longer had to spend her nights at the office preparing the brief of evidence, wondering resentfully which witness statements the DPP would ask them to retake because it was their job to doubt every piece of evidence. Like she should have done. She and Nico could share a bottle of wine tonight and sleep late tomorrow. They would have sex tonight and in the morning and probably the afternoon. This wasn't a career case that would put her face on the front page of the newspaper. It was a cute dinner party story she'd tell with Nico's arm slung around the back of her chair. Or, more likely, Nico would tell it for her and she'd make small factual corrections. She glanced at Ethan, who was smiling sentimentally at Joy and Stan as though he were father of the bloody bride. He caught her looking and abruptly adjusted his face. "Perhaps we could speak privately, Mrs. Delaney," she said to Joy. "You can tell us what's been going on and where you've been all this time." Chapter 65. Valentine's Day. He was gone. The air vibrated with the terrible words they'd hurled. Joy walked in a daze down the hallway, back into the kitchen, and looked around her. Her empty water glass sat on the sink. She put it in the dishwasher, closed the dishwasher, wiped a single droplet of water off the sink. Right then. It used to be that when Stan left, the fast-running current of Joy's life picked her up and carried her through until he returned. But now there were no children to distract or console, no lessons to reschedule, no business to run. She had no idea what to do next. She didn't know how to fill her day. She didn't know how to fill her life. The dusty bottle of whiskey still sat on the kitchen table. She poured herself a shot glass with shaking hands and drank it in one dramatic gulp, like a person in a movie. She shuddered. Whiskey was awful, but she enjoyed the slow warmth it created, like an electric blanket heating up cold sheets. She saw a pair of nail scissors sitting innocently on top of the junk in the bowl on the sideboard, as if they had always been there. So she sat at the table and trimmed the two broken nails that had scratched Stan's face, while she wondered if they could ever come back from this, or if they'd finally reached the end of their forgiveness, their love, their patience. It occurred to her that she wanted to be gone when Stan came back. For once, she wanted him at home waiting for her. But where could she go? She was in the process of idly Googling answers to all her problems when her phone rang, like a gift. Her heart lifted. She answered without looking at the name. Surely it would be one of the children, remembering at last that they had a mother. Her money was on Brooke. "Hello? Joy?" She recognised the voice instantly. "Savannah." Her eyes went to Harry Haddad's memoir sitting on the table in front of her. Should she hang up? She had once answered a late-night call from a young man who Joy knew was trying to scam her because he was telling her that she'd won some extraordinary prize and just needed to pay a nominal fee for shipment, and Joy had let him rattle on for ages, just for the company. They'd ended up having an interesting chat about climate change before she told him that he really needed to consider a more honourable choice of career, at which point he hung up on her. She felt the same way about Savannah. She knew she should be wary, and she was wary. But she was also lonely. "How are you, Savannah?" she asked. "Cool, but not cold. Where are you?" "Great, Joy," said Savannah. "Excellent. Top of the world. How are you this morning?" Oh, dear. She seemed to be channeling the fast-talking energy of a door-to-door salesman who knows he only has seconds before the door is shut in his face. Joy felt a sudden spurt of fury. "You know, I'm not great, Savannah. I'm not actually having the best day. As it happens, I'm drinking whiskey in the morning. So if you're calling for another spot of blackmail..." "I'm not," said Savannah, "because I hope you know that what you did to us was unacceptable," said Joy. "If you'd gone public with those accusations about Stan, you could have ruined our lives forever." "I returned the money," said Savannah, "and I never would have done that." "Well, I don't know what you would have done, do I?" There was no answer. They sat in silence for a few moments, and Joy remembered the day she came back from the hospital and how Savannah had brought a tray to her in bed with a cup of tea and tiny triangles of cinnamon toast. My goodness, that toast had been nice. "Okay, then," she said in the appeased, let's move on tone she used to employ with her children when their behaviour had been unacceptable, but there was nothing more to be said. "Well, what have you been up to?" "I'm in a sort of new relationship," answered Savannah. "He's a doctor, a plastic surgeon, lots of money. I'm calling from his apartment. I'm kind of living here now." "That's wonderful news," said Joy warmly. She was rehabilitating herself. She was turning her life around. "I'm so happy for..." "He's married," interrupted Savannah. "It's more of an affair than a relationship." "Oh," said Joy sadly. "Joy." It was her. The act was gone. She sounded the way Joy's children used to sound when they called, and as soon as she heard them speak, she knew there was a crisis. The match had been lost. A heart had been broken. She steeled herself, as she used to steel herself, for the blow to the stomach of her children's bad news. "What is it? Tell me." "My brother has written a memoir," said Savannah. "My father emailed it to me. The publishers are sending it out to anyone who is mentioned in the book for fact-checking." "I know," said Joy. "We got a copy too." She pulled the manuscript towards her and flicked the stack of pages with her thumb. "Stan has read it. I haven't read it yet." "I wasn't going to read it," said Savannah. "I thought, what do I care? I don't want to read about your wonderful, successful life. But then I got curious." "Well, of course," said Joy. "My dad told my brother I was sick," said Savannah. She spoke mechanically now. "That's how he motivated him. He thought he was playing to save my life." "Yes, Stan told me that," said Joy. "He was upset to hear it." She said carefully, "I assume you didn't know?" "Of course I didn't know. I thought he was having a wonderful life, eating steak while I starved. I hated him." "Oh, Savannah," said Joy, "I hope you know you're not responsible for what your father did." "You know how it started? I really was in hospital, said Savannah. I ate a cupcake at school, so my mother made me drink salt water until I vomited. I got dehydrated and collapsed after I performed. She spoke as if being forced to drink salt water was the sort of thing any mother would do. Joy put two fingertips to her forehead. Good Lord. So then my mother sent my dad a photo of me at the hospital with a drip in my arm to make him feel bad so he'd send more money. My dad showed Harry that photo to make him feel bad. And that's when he started this whole charade. I see, said Joy. So when did he finally realize you weren't sick? It seems like there wasn't a big revelation. It just slowly crept up on him that he'd been duped. But by then his tennis career was properly taking off, and then, ironically, he ends up with a child who really does get seriously sick. My niece. Joy heard Savannah sniff. I heard his daughter was sick, and I did nothing. I felt nothing, literally nothing. I'm no different from all those people who ignored me. I'm a terrible person, Joy. No, you're not. Oh, I am, said Savannah. I really am. Joy stood up from the table. She picked up one of the framed photos of her children. It was Amy's 30th birthday. They stood in a line, arms around each other, smiling.
You need to call your brother, said Joy.
There was a long pause. Savannah sniffed again. I talked to my dad. He says Harry wouldn't be where he was today if my father hadn't given him such a good incentive to win in the early days. My dad thinks it's funny. Isn't that sick? My family is so sick.
Yes, said Joy. It's awful.
Tennis parents can be awful. Anyway, so I wanted to tell you I'm going away, said Savannah. She'd changed tone again, brusque. I've actually signed up for one of Harry's cancer charity things. It's stupid, I know. It's not like that will change anything. But I wanted to do something for him, to atone. When I feel bad, I like to take action.
Sure, said Joy. I understand.
She kind of understood. She wasn't one to wallow. It starts tonight. It's called the 21-Day Off-Grid Challenge to End Childhood Cancer. You stay in these tiny solar-powered cabins in the middle of nowhere without phones or Wi-Fi. You don't even get the address of where you're staying until the day you leave. I thought, well, it's not just supporting Harry's charity. It might clear my mind, like a circuit breaker. I don't understand. How does doing this end childhood cancer? Oh, well, it doesn't, obviously, but you pay a fortune and a percentage goes to cancer research, said Savannah. People sponsor you. It's for wealthy people. They post about it on Instagram. She put on a posh accent. I'm just so humbled to be able to do my bit for this important cause. You know the type. Obviously, I'm not wealthy, but I am very cashed up at the moment. She paused. Don't ask. I will not ask, said Joy. I hope you're not going anywhere near the fires. Opposite direction, said Savannah. It's a 5-hour drive, a place called Oraru Gully. Oraru means wind through the trees, so that sounds nice, I guess. It's got waterfalls and lakes and wildlife or whatever. Oh, I think it sounds wonderful, Savannah, said Joy. Yeah, said Savannah. Although, I don't know, I'm having second thoughts. I might get lonely. I might lose my mind. I might seriously lose my mind. Joy put down the framed photo. She looked at the walls that trapped her and thought of waterfalls and lakes and wildlife. What if I came with you? Yes, said Savannah. Yes, please, Joy. Once the decision was made, Joy was a whirl of nervous energy. She wanted to be gone before Stan came back. She wanted him to return to an empty house. She'd never made a decision this significant without first consulting Stan. It was exhilarating. It was terrifying. It would show him. It would show the children. Everyone would be very surprised. Her friends would be surprised too. It would be nice to be surprising for once. This would be a circuit breaker. She was enamoured of Savannah's phrase and kept murmuring it as she got ready. This was exactly what she needed right now, for a circuit to be broken. Stan would miss her, or he wouldn't miss her. If they didn't miss each other, then the decision would be made. She couldn't find her phone, even though she'd just been talking on it. She couldn't find her glasses, even though she'd been wearing them just minutes ago. She couldn't find her wallet. She found her phone. She texted the children without her glasses, the words blurry on the screen. Nobody texted or called straight back, as if the fact that their mother was going off-grid for 3 weeks was of little interest. She found her wallet. She found her glasses. She dragged out an old promotional backpack from the bottom of the cupboard and shoved in casual clothes, something warm for at night. Shorts and T-shirts, swimmers and runners, underwear and PJs, a brand new toothbrush still in its packaging. Savannah said they would swim and do bushwalks each day, rest and read. No need for fancy clothes, no need for much at all. It was about minimalism, apparently. It was about reconnecting with your true self. It was possibly a load of nonsense, but Joy could always come home early if she got bored. She sat down and wrote Stan a letter. Dear Stan, I'm so sorry for saying those terrible things. Delaney's would have been nothing without you. I ran the business, but you were the business, Stan. You were the talent. Nobody could coach like you. Nobody could get the best out of a player like you. Even the hopeless ones. Especially the hopeless ones. You never gave a half-hearted lesson. I did. I admit it. I loved watching you coach, even more than I loved watching you play. It was like seeing an artist at work. I probably never told you that before. I should have. I'm sorry for what I did. I'm sorry for sending Harry away. I wanted our children to have the best coach in Australia, and that was you. It was wrong for you, but right for our children. And I chose them. You were right when you said, if I'd really wanted to make it with my own tennis, I would have done it. But I was good enough, Stan. I was so. I know it. You know it too. I never regretted that decision. I think I just wanted it acknowledged. But, oh well, it doesn't really matter now. There is something important I need to say. It was hard to live like that all those years, Stan, knowing that you could walk out the door at any moment. Each time it happened, it made my heart freeze a bit more, until I thought it would freeze solid. So, now it's my turn to walk out. I'm going away with Savannah. I know you're still angry with her, and rightly so, but she's just a mixed-up kid, and I feel we have a kind of responsibility. We're doing Harry's 21-day off-grid challenge to end childhood cancer. It's not costing us anything. She's already paid. It's for charity, which is nice. I'm staying in a tiny, sustainable, solar-powered house with her. I do hope you've been exaggerating about my snoring. There's a phone number you can call if there's an emergency, but otherwise I will be properly off-grid. When I come home, maybe we can come up with a new strategy for how to be happy for this part of our life. We're so good at strategy. I think we can do it. So I guess the ball is in your court, my darling. That's a good one, eh? Love, Joy. P.S. My bike got a puncture and I left it under a tree in front of the O'Brien's old house. Will you please pick it up for me? P.P.S. I'm sorry for scratching you. My nails keep breaking. I think I need more calcium. She carefully put the note on the refrigerator door with the London Eye magnet, right up high, where it would be impossible for him to miss it. She would not do to him what he'd done to her all those times. There would be no mystery as to her whereabouts. Now, her phone, which she'd had just 5 minutes ago, was missing again. She spent a few precious minutes looking for it before giving up. She didn't need a phone. That was the point of this challenge. She was unplugging. She was going off-grid. She filled up the dog's food and water bowls and told her where she was going and asked her to please take care of Stan. Steffi gave a low growl of disapproval. No, Steffi, I think it is a good idea, said Joy. And she slung her backpack over her shoulder and felt as young and adventurous as if she were off to go backpacking around Europe. The moment she closed the front door, her phone, which she'd knocked onto the floor as she swept up her backpack and then kicked under the bed as she left the room, began to buzz and vibrate with confused text messages from her children. Huh? Mum, this message makes no sense. Her plan was to walk to the bus stop and catch the 401 into town, where Savannah would pick her up in a fancy car her married boyfriend was lending her. Caro's daughter was pulling out of her driveway at the same time as Joy left the house. Petra opened her window to say hello, and when she found out that Joy was catching a bus into the city, she offered Joy a lift, because she happened to be going to a literary lecture at the State Library, which was excellent luck. Not a nice day to be outside. On the way into the city, they had a very nice chat about Copenhagen, where Petra lived now, and was flying back to the very next morning with two small children. The children were with Caro right now, seeing a movie, a last day excursion with their beloved grandma. They talked about how everyone rode bikes in Denmark and wore flat, comfy shoes, and Joy asked if Petra had met Princess Mary. She hadn't. And she told her how just this morning she'd tried to be one of those lovely, relaxed European ladies on a bike, but it hadn't turned out so well. Meanwhile, back at the house, the London Eye fridge magnet slid slowly, inevitably towards the kitchen floor, taking Joy's letter with it. Steffi lifted her head from her paws, patted across the floor, and leisurely devoured the whole delicious sheet of paper. 5 minutes after Caro's daughter dropped Joy off, she got a frantic call from her mother saying that her son had fallen over on their way into the cinema and she was taking him to the hospital because she was worried his arm was broken. Petra missed her lecture and drove straight to the hospital. Her son's arm was not broken, only bruised, and they were able to make their flight the next day. No problem. But with all the drama, it was not surprising that she entirely forgot to mention to her mother that she'd given her neighbour a lift into the city. At least, not until 3 weeks later, when Petra was back in Denmark and her mother said that Joy Delaney had been missing for 3 weeks. Chapter 66. Now. Amy had no aptitude for languages, but she did do French in high school, and she could remember the satisfaction of watching a paragraph of nonsensical words magically morph into sensible sentences. And that was exactly what was happening to her now as she studied her mother's nonsensical text message. Going off-grid for a little while. I'm dancing daffodils 21 dog champagne to end Czechoslovakia. Spangle moot. Love, Mum. The words became going off grid for a little while. I'm doing Harry's 21-day challenge to end childhood cancer. Sponsor me. Love, Mum. She read the message out loud. Once. Twice.
Do you think that's where she could be?
Said Simon, in another one of his crisp white t-shirts, looking up at her anxiously.
It's possible?
Amy nodded. It's possible. It made sense. It made perfect sense. At this moment, everything made perfect, exquisite sense.
It's also possible I love you,
she whispered, without meeting his eyes or moving her lips, as if she were operating a ventriloquist's doll, as if it might not count if she didn't say it properly. In a minute, this beautiful clarity would be gone. Another man would have said, "What did you just say?" And she wouldn't have said it again. Another man would have tried to hug her or kiss her, and she would have stood as stiff as a board in his arms, because right now she couldn't be touched. But Simon Barrington wasn't another man. He didn't move or smile or try to make eye contact. He looked straight ahead at his laptop and said, formally and clearly and quite loudly, as if he were making a legally binding declaration to a government official, "I love you too, Amy." It wasn't the first time she'd heard those words from a man. It was just the first time she believed them. Minutes later, the phones of the four Delaney children dinged simultaneously in locations across Sydney, and each phone was snatched up with fumbling, frightened fingers as they read a five-word text from an unknown number. It said, "Your mother is home. Dad." Stan's first ever text from his brand new phone turned out to be his most memorable. Chapter 67. When Joy's children saw her again, they each hugged her in a way they hadn't hugged her since childhood. They were the fierce, desperate hugs that once followed nightmares, when she could feel the rapid hammer of fragile hearts in tiny chests as they clung to her. Both her sons lifted her clear off the floor, just like their father did. Both her sons cried, just like their father did. Neither of her daughters shed a tear. They scolded her, like frightened mothers scold lost children on their return. "You must promise to never, ever do anything like that again, Mum. You must wear your glasses when you send a text. You must never leave the house without your phone." She enjoyed being told off by them. She could hear the rhythms of her own voice, her mother's voice, her grandmother's voice, every relieved, cranky woman from the beginning of time. It was nice to hold on to the memories of those fierce, desperate hugs when the hugging stopped. Chapter 68. Joy could remember people in late January talking about some kind of dreadful virus creeping across the world, but she was too distracted by her crumbling marriage to take much notice. And besides, she never caught colds. She had an excellent immune system. By the time she was back on the grid, the world had spun off its axis, and it was hard not to feel personally responsible, as if the moment she stopped supervising, chaos was the consequence. It was just like when she took her eyes off Troy as a toddler, the mayhem and destruction that followed. Suddenly, everyone was social distancing, especially around Stan and Joy, who were supposedly elderly and at risk. When they went for a walk, younger people leaped elaborately out of the way, off footpaths and into gutters. "If my time's up, my time's up," Stan told the children, and the children groaned and said all their friends' parents were making similarly foolhardy comments. And Joy and Stan exchanged smiles and made solemn promises to behave. Those first weeks after Joy returned home were like being on a honeymoon in the middle of an apocalypse. They couldn't stop touching each other or watching the news, which for the first time in Joy's lifetime was global and enormous, yet personal and specific. You couldn't shrug it off. You couldn't say it was very sad, but life goes on, because life didn't go on. They couldn't stop saying they couldn't believe it. Prince Charles got the virus. No one was safe, not even royalty. Lockdown took the pressure off retirement. Now their only responsibility was to stay home and stay safe, not to partake in a daily repertoire of wholesome bracing activities. Now it wasn't just their lives that had stopped, but everyone's lives. Now it wasn't just her formerly bustling home that had fallen silent, but formerly bustling cities all around the world. People heard birdsong in places where they had once only heard traffic. Skies cleared. If only this beautiful global pause could have happened without the relentless suffering. Joy kept thinking about her grandmother's first husband, who had died of the Spanish flu 100 years ago after he made the silly decision to go meet his friend down at the docks. It had always sounded like a fairy tale to Joy and a necessary piece of her history. Of course that first husband had to make the silly decision to meet his friend at the docks so Joy's grandmother could go on to marry Joy's beautiful grandfather and Joy would then come to be Joy. For the first time ever, it occurred to Joy that her grandmother's first husband probably would have preferred not to die of the Spanish flu, thank you very much, just like Joy would prefer not to die of this one. She wanted to see what happened next. Her grandparents and mother would have to wait at that arrivals gate for a little longer. It took a while for Joy to fully comprehend what her family had been through while she was gone. Stan told her that all four children initially withheld information from the police that they knew would make Stan appear guilty. He'd seen their doubt and fear increase exponentially as the days passed without their mother's return. Their questions became increasingly pointed. "I started to feel guilty," said Stan. "I started to feel as if I had hurt you. I had dreams that..." He stopped. "The dreams were bad." The children referred to their confused loyalties, both obliquely and overtly. In the middle of an impassioned lecture about hand sanitizing and face masks, Brooke suddenly said, apropos of nothing, "I found that criminal lawyer for Dad because I knew he was innocent, Mum, not because I thought he was guilty. I hope you both know that." "Oh, my darling," thought Joy, "you never could lie." Once, after Troy dropped off a lavish 24-pack of toilet paper he'd naturally managed to procure during the bizarre panic-buying frenzy, and when he and Joy were alone, sitting on the back veranda at a safe social distance, he said, "I thought Dad might have done it, Mum. I actually thought it, and I was angry with Brooke because she was supporting him." He sounded just like when he was a little boy, confessing something unspeakable. And Joy said, "It doesn't matter, darling. Just put it out of your mind." Putting things out of your mind wasn't the modern way, but where else could he put it? Troy and Brooke patched up their differences, thank God, in the way that siblings and spouses sometimes did, with actions rather than words. Brooke bought Troy a box of chocolates. Troy bought Brooke a car. Joy and Stan didn't talk at all about Harry Haddad until one day when they were watching the news and it was announced that Wimbledon would be cancelled because of the pandemic, the first time that had happened since World War II. "I understand why you did what you did," said Stan quietly. He didn't say he forgave her, but she took it as forgiveness. A younger couple might have spent months in counselling, talking it through, but she knew they were done with it. Move on.
Once you've hit a ball, there's no point watching to see where it's going. You can't change its flight path now. You have to think about your next move. Not what you should have done. What you do now. She had betrayed him. He chose to still love her. There was nothing more to say. There were awful possibilities that kept her up at night. For example, what if she and Savannah had been in an accident and their car had disappeared forever beneath the murky depths of some lake, and Stan had then been arrested and charged with her murder? What if he'd languished in jail for the rest of his life and only Brooke had visited him? In the early days, she made a lot of phone calls to that pretty, impatient and unsmiling Detective Christina Khoury. Joy was mildly obsessed with her. "Leave the woman alone," Stan said. He looked traumatized whenever her name came up, which was why Joy felt a strange desire to continue convincing Christina of Stan's innocence, even though his innocence was undisputed. She needed the detective to know that her husband was 100% innocent. He absolutely did not murder her.
"We did have a strong circumstantial case, Mrs. Delaney," said Christina grimly.
But then Christina softened and reminded her of all the reasons why her various fears would never have eventuated. "For one thing," she said dryly, "Joy and Savannah had not crossed any lakes on their drive, so it was unlikely they would have ended up at the bottom of one. Furthermore, Savannah's married lover, or boyfriend, or fling, or whatever you wanted to call him, her mark, Dr. Henry Edgeworth, would have finally led them to Savannah, and Savannah would have led them to Harry's off-grid challenge. More importantly, they would also have got that better late than never statement from Caro's daughter in Copenhagen. The case wasn't built on truth, so it would have inevitably collapsed like a stack of cards. Your husband would never have been convicted."